Good morning, folks. Please have a seat. We'll get started. The panelists sit over on the left-hand side here. Look for your or right from the other opposite side, my left. And all the panelists may or may not be here yet. I'm not sure. I haven't seen everyone. One thing I'm going to tell you right now is that, and if you're interested and have a machine, you should start downloading. Do we have folks on the phone, first of all?
Yes.
Okay. This will apply to you, too. Under oh, okay. Have we tested it? Yeah, it'll work. Okay. Anyways, we have a video, but I think we're going to have the streaming version of it, so we don't have to pre-download it. Welcome, everyone. Welcome our panelists, participants yesterday, new ones today. Ram and I are going to kick off the second day. Second day is really focused on two primary activities, the panel in the morning, and we have a good set of panelists. Three from the government, U.S. federal government, and two from academia, and one from an advanced application company, ontology application company. And they're all going to be addressing issues in the real-world use of ontologies. We'll introduce them when the panel begins. The second part of today is, of course, the presentation of the communique in the afternoon. We'll see, in fact, that if you'll look at the link, let's see, do we have it? Yes, so under 145, presentation of the communique, if you click on the Google Doc link, Ontology Summit 2011, communique version 1, you'll see that there is a slight modification. There was some midnight activity going on that tried to, in fact, add some integration material. So what I suggest is you look this over during the course of the morning, and then in the afternoon, when the co-leads co-lead editors introduce the communique, that we get any comments that folks may have. We think that this actually adds to it and to the communique and emphasizes more of the integration across the communique that maybe was slightly lacking. But review that, please. We don't think it's controversial, but we will still, people can provide comments. Okay, what I'd like to do is introduce Nicola Guarino and Steve Ray, who will have a few comments if they're interested in commenting. Okay. Okay, so probably the goals of the day are basically provide different perspectives through the use, through the panelists of the on the real world use of ontologies, but from their perspective, they'll all be slightly different perspectives, their view of the current state of the art and future directions. It could be technical directions, it could be programmatic directions, adoption directions, et cetera, their views. Let's see, do we have three panelists. And, yeah, Bill, he may be getting coffee or, oh, there he is, okay. Yeah, so Bill and let's see, who else? Michael Gruninger and Nicola.
Judge Strong is the director of National Coordination Office for Technology
Welcome everyone. So the way we have the panel structured today, basically it's in two parts, and we're providing the panelists approximately 7-8 minutes. We're not going to be extremely strict. We want to make sure that we have input from the panelists that they choose to provide, but we want to have a lot of time for discussion. So what I suggest is that we have possibly some intermittent discussion with the panelists, and then at the end of the panel, we'll have a kind of general discussion on what we heard today, and of course the panelists can participate in that too, to gauge ourselves and address ourselves where we think things are and where things are going. So with that, I'd like to introduce the panelists. Oh, it's changed. And what I'll do is they're all present, so I'll introduce them first, and then we'll get started. George Strawn is director of the National Coordination Office for Networking Information Technology Research and Development for the government. And so there's a lot of cross-connecting programs that office addresses, and We've known of George for quite some time. Also, George Thomas, who's an enterprise architect, Department of Homeland, not Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, and has been working in particular with data.gov, which we know has a semantic web component. Dennis Wisnowski, who's the chief architect and CTO in the Department of Defense for focusing on the business mission area. Dennis will talk about a large-scale semantic web program that he has in his organization. The second part of the morning, then, we'll have Bill Anderson of HighFleet, formerly Ontology Works. And Bill, of course, is a chief scientist on one of the most advanced, complex uses of ontologies for mission applications. Then we'll follow Bill with Michael Gruninger, University of Toronto, who has been involved with ontologies since really the rise of ontology engineering in the early 90s. And then Nicola Guarino, who is at the University of Trento in Italy, and I guess the same thing really applies to Nicola. He made a difference in bringing ontological analysis to the forefront in the emerging field of ontology engineering. And of course, he's the president of the International Association of for ontology and its applications, a new professional organization that was founded just last year. Welcome, panelists. If you have material, let us know, and we'll place that up if it isn't already placed up. But in any case, we'll get started. And George Strawn, do you want to begin the?
Well, I don't know. They always say the first layer doesn't have a chance. I guess that's me. So, yes, Leo, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Very happy to be here. I'm glad to salute you for your ecumenical nature of inviting non-specialists to be on a panel. So I'm aware that I'm in the presence of specialists, and so anything that I say as a sentence, you should always interpret as a question. And I'm anxious to be corrected by you all as the morning goes forward. I've hung around the IT profession for some time, and over the decades, it seems like every decade something new comes up that particularly attracts my attention. And the next decade, when it becomes mainstream, it isn't quite what we thought it was going to be, but it turns out to be important, in some cases more important. Time sharing was like that in the 60s. Maybe the people at MIT knew how it was going to turn out, but the rest of us didn't, but it was very exciting. Of course, it was a transitional technology, as it turned out. PCs in the 70s were much the same way. At my university, we started producing PCs with the Intel 404, which went back quite a ways. In the 80s, I got involved with the internet. Also got involved with expert systems, which sort of fizzled out, but, well, maybe we're back now, right? In a new form. The internet brought me to Washington, where on a temporary two-year assignment in 1991, and I haven't gone back yet. In the 90s, the web layer on top of the internet turned out to do miraculous things for us, and that has continued to morph in the aughts. I became aware of the semantic web introductory dimension to semantics and ontology pushing 10 years ago, and an old bureaucrat needs some hobby to have in the evening, and that looked like a pretty good hobby, so I've stuck my nose into it for some period of time. Matter of fact, now in this interagency coordination effort, NITERD, that was referred to, that I have the privilege of chairing, we're in the process of standing up a SWOT team, Semantic Web and Ontologies, where we hope to bring together, first of all, interested persons within the federal government to share knowledge and progress on these matters. And if we can figure out a way, we may try to have a penumbra of broader involvement from the community that's interested in this as well. I will say this is one of the first times I've been accused of being a member of the real world. So that's a pleasant first time for me. Well, all right, with that as sort of a quick overview of where I've been, let me say what is interesting me in terms of potential applications for the semantic technology right now. Our office reports to the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, and a year ago they said, hey, we want a dashboard, which is one of the sound bites that's used in Washington these days. A dashboard means we want a whole bunch of information summarized, but we want to be able to drill down to any level of detail that we may want to see. In particular, research and development dashboards are of interest to policymakers downtown and Congress. And in our little corner of the world, IT research and development dashboards. Well, we have 16 agencies in our organization, so that means it at least 18 different formats of information. And so right away, if we're going to produce something, then interoperability of information of different formats, heterogeneous data, is something that would seem to attract a possible semantic interpretation. So we've been investigating that. We've done a small pilot project just simply somaticizing the data in summary tables that can't be drilled down because the agencies currently tell us about their investments in a one-line format rather than a detailed project format. Several of our agencies already have put information in the public. NIH has a NIH reporter, which gives a record for every one of their grants in biomedical research, and NSF has a public database called research.gov, which has a record for every one of their funded grants across all areas of science. We have then 14 other agencies that are in a lesser stage of public availability, but we expect that to come too. Working with some of my friends at NIH, I discovered in the basement of NLM an investigator who's been working away for 20 years on what I would call a very intriguing somatic project, which to me is a step beyond dashboarding. I'll mention it just briefly because it excites me as a scientist in terms of new methods of scientific discovery. I presume some of you have probably read the Microsoft volume put out in honor of the deceased Jim Gray a couple years ago called The Fourth Paradigm. I'd recommend it to you if you haven't read it. One of the sections deals with information per se, one of the articles, it's a compendium of articles, and one article, I can't remember which one now, uses a soundbite: one goal is to make the scientific record a first-class scientific object. Okay, well, that means both scientific literature and scientific data. If we can mine new science out of scientific literature and scientific data, well, that's not a bad goal. Well, that's what I see the pioneering work of Tom Reinflesch at NLM as paving the way for. You may be familiar with the Medline database that NLM maintains of biomedical research articles, abstracts, and titles. It has millions and millions across the decades. Reinflesch has taken the most recent 9 or 10 million of those articles and has somaticized them. And I'll say just a minute about what that means for him and what he's able to do with it. He was born and raised a linguist, in fact, a linguist of the old style who actually does sentence structure rather than statistical relationships of words. And he is able, applying his linguistic background, to find the appropriate noun phrases and verb phrases, which allows him to come up with triples. And he has a wonderful vocabulary that's been under development at NLM for decades called Unified Medical Language System, UMLS. So he has a pre-existent, although somewhat complex, vocabulary, and non-statistical parsing capabilities. He can find the triples. He looks for what he calls the key sentences in these abstracts. His guess is, and he's not a rash guesser, his guess is that he can find 75% of the key sentences of the abstracts of these articles. And of course, it's filtering out the non-key sentences as well as putting in a standard format the triples, which are, then become the key sentences. These then, of course, in graph format can be displayed as a large graph. Well, you of course want to start out with a Google-like search to focus in on a particular period of time or two or three particular topical areas, and maybe you get yourself 100 articles that reference what you're interested in. And then a beautiful graphical display pops up, and right there in front of your nose you can see connections between concepts from different articles. I've seen him demonstrate this several times, and I think that this is in fact an incipient new method of scientific discovery in terms of how things that we thought were separated are in fact closely related to each other. Of course, each of these links you can click through immediately to the abstract of the article which gave that link to the big graph, and allow you to go back and do more detailed reading of the actual material. He finds about, I think I may have said, he finds about three key sentences per abstract. So he has on the order of 30 million, a graph of 30 million triples. It just looks to me like something that it's ripe for experiments in other disciplines to see just how general and capable this method is. Of course, it requires some interdisciplinary work from the semantic and ontology community, and even worse, requires some grunt work that nobody wants to do and nobody wants to pay for. With the exception of NLM, with this UMLS language system, who else wants to spend time and energy producing a large vocabulary for each scientific discipline? Well, I haven't found very many people who are willing to do that yet. But if we could find that, creating a large thesaurus plus ontology, let's say, for the various scientific disciplines, and then take Ryan Flesch's linguistics code to see if it can be, to see whether, unbeknownst to him, there is intelligence of the biomed style of writing embedded in that code, or whether it is easily generalizable to finding the noun phrases and verb phrases in other scientific disciplines as well. I think we might be. I think we have. Over this decade, we should have some interesting scientific research in combining the semantics with vocabulary. There's got to be more automated methods of producing vocabularies. Maybe some exist that I'm just not aware of. And I've been told by other linguists that they've pushed the probabilistic stuff about as far as it can go, and many of them are heading back toward a structural analysis. This may be one of the motivations to do so. That's all I'll say about application areas that I find particularly interesting. And as I say, combining the work of groups like this with an automated way to create large vocabularies, technical vocabularies, and a natural language processing investigation, I think would be very interesting. I'm spending some time trying to figure out how to explain semantic technologies to decision makers. Now, as an expert once said at a recent workshop where I was, the semantic web, and I think all of ontological work, is hard to evangelize for. If the people you're talking to don't know what it is, how do you tell them quickly what's going on? Well, I'm an old computer science professor, and unlike most of my colleagues, I enjoyed teaching the survey courses, you know, computer science for poets and that type of thing. So I've been working for almost the last year on coming up with a tutorial that would allow me to explain to decision makers in a few slides what's going on and why they should pay attention to this technology, and maybe establish an area of expertise within their domain to proceed. I also think that it's not that easy to explain this stuff to IT types. It's different enough from traditional IT that when I go talk to my colleagues, and I was CIO at NSF before taking this job, you find that many traditional IT people take the news calmly. And don't get as excited, let's say, as I have. In fact, probably the group that I think is most involved from, quote, the real world and people that I work pretty hard on engaging is librarians. Ontology business, in some sense, may be the new librarianship as we get rid of all of our paper, and they've got to have something to do. Well, figuring out how to utilize. I see two jobs for the librarians of the future: archiving data as well as text, and making both the data and text much more accessible by applying semantic technologies to them. And that means they've got a little bit to learn, but it's much more in keeping with the reference librarianship and other types of cataloging activities that they've done for at least 500 years since Gutenberg. So I find librarians are ready partners to learn about this stuff. And my IT friends are a little more difficult, and decision makers are just saying, why should I bother? Can you explain to me why I should take my valuable time to hear you out any further? And I'm working on a few ideas like that. Stay tuned. I'll let you know how it goes. So thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Our next speaker is George Thomas.
Thanks, Leo. Thank you, George. I was fortunate to meet Tom at NLM through George's work, and it was fascinating to say, hey, George, hey, Tom, here's this Affordable Care Act document. Why don't you parse that and see what sort of data model you end up with and how you might be able to traverse the things that are described in there. So really fascinating capabilities with some of these folks at NLM. One of the things that I'm involved in is a new W3C group that is a government-linked data working group. So it's a W3C member-only group. For those of you that are W3C members here, it would be fantastic to see you get involved in that group, especially if you're interested in hurling insults at linked data practitioners or assuming that they, you know, don't like ontologies or whatever the case might be. So I'm going to be co-chairing that with a woman named Bernadette Highland, who's pretty well known in the community here from who's now with Talis. And is the CEO of Talis US arm. So we'd be pleased to take on some aspects of the charter, one of which will not include some of the impediments to real world use. So linked data folks are obsessed with HTTP dereferenceable URIs, which is not necessarily the case with all ontologists in the world. And in some cases, some of the work that George has already mentioned, for example, UMLS, this is the Universal Medical Language System, I believe is what the UMLS stands for, which is the kind of thing that Tom Reinflesch at NLM is expert in dealing with. There are some intellectual property concerns that explicitly make it impossible to create dereferenceable or HTTP dereferenceable URI versions of these types of ontologies, which of course represents an umbrella of a number of vocabularies that have been brought together. So the W3C Government Linked Data Working Group will not address that particular very difficult issue or the licensing of vocabularies that either exist or being created, but they will address vocabularies themselves and sort of what vocabularies are useful for cross-cutting concerns of all open government data. And if you are minting URIs and designing vocabularies, as the RDFS practitioners typically say, as opposed to ontologies, which usually means some owl in some form, then there'll be some best practices associated with that, much of which already exists, and the work of the Government Linked Data Group will be sort of putting a government stamp of approval on some guidance coming out of the W3C. So just wanted to give you an idea of what's going to be happening with the W3C. In terms of data.gov, so I've been fortunate to work with data.gov over the past year or so. Many of you probably are aware there's, the depth of the use of semantic web technologies or linked data implementations on data.gov is somewhat thin so far. RDF XML is seen as kind of another serialization format for your CSV files, and most often, they're zipped up. So if you want to download a data dump in an RDF XML serialization, you can. So clearly there's a long way to go in terms of the cross-domain correlation we're trying to enable across different agency missions. For example, what's the relationship of this environmental data with this health data, et cetera. So there is not necessarily a top-down approach to linked data or government linked data as there as we see in other open government data movements, such as in the UK, where they explicitly set out to do linked data. So it's been kind of a grassroots do-it-yourself kind of effort within the data.gov PMO. So there is a Wednesday, recurring Wednesday morning semantic web linked data practitioner or wannabe practitioner call that is actually open. So if anybody's interested in participating in that, folks like Bernadette and myself, the EPA, are very active in this. And what we are typically doing is discussing the kind of grassroots work that people like myself are doing within our respective agencies. So at HHS, I've been working with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to produce the first shot across the bow in terms of government-linked data, which is to the clinical quality domain in CMS. And so we're taking some of the popular or high-value data from CMS, such as the COMPARE data sets, hospital COMPARE, physician COMPARE, et cetera. And we are webifying them, I think, as some folks would say. So we are reusing a number of simple ontologies and vocabularies, and we have created a handful of component vocabularies, each with just a handful or two concepts and relations in them. And
the moderator has disconnected.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So so this work will launch, is intended to launch on and certainly is progressing towards launching on the anniversary of data.gov this year, which is upcoming in May under health.data.gov. So currently healthdata.gov or health.data.gov redirect you to data.gov/health, which is a kind of a Drupal-sided community site, which is championed by the HHS CTO, Todd Park. So the intent is to have health.data.gov be the linked data site where we're defining our vocabularies and identifying our real world and abstract and concrete things that we would like to establish authoritative URIs for such that others in the world can link to. So that's basically what's happening within CMS. EPA has some very similar work that's going on around their facility registries service. So we're excited to start to get some actual linked data going around focusing on data.gov and the open government data initiative in general. So that's pretty much what I wanted to share with you this morning. The W3C activity, what's the relationship of data.gov and the work in CMS. I don't know if we're taking questions now or.
George, in the what the health is doing with the variation on data.gov and getting to, as you called it, authoritative vocabularies, what's the social dimension around that? How are, you know, communities of interest, like, focus, you know, going to interact with that process? Or are they interacting with it?
Well, I suppose the usual government approach would be to get probably this number of people in a room over the course of 5 years and work on defining one term. I think the intent, certainly what I find most interesting in the pursuit that that I'm advocating is more of the so-called social data capabilities. So there are a number of, some of these things were mentioned in the call yesterday, and many of you are aware of the social media orientation. So treat the development of the vocabulary or the ontology and the things in it as a social object. So I think that that might facilitate the development and let's say lower the coordination cost of the emergence of these reusable things.
Just one quick follow-up. Is Is there an outreach to bring together like libraries and there are authoritative sources of information in the health field that are non-government or are there bringing in commercial and other nonprofit overseas to kind of sync up? I mean, I'm curious.
Yes, certainly, and all the things that George alluded to within HHS, there's a rich history of the use of ontologies. So basically what's happening with the CMS project is put it out there and let people shoot holes in it or tell me that I should have used the HL7 URI for hospital or let them, tell us how to make it better, et cetera, and we'll sort of see what happens. Just do it is kind of what we're up to.
Todd?
Could you expand more on what you said about the development of an ontology as a social affair? Do you have a specific paradigm in mind?
Sure. So I guess around this time last year, Google acquired Freebase. All right. So on Freebase, what you do is you design your RDFS schema, and you create instances of that schema, and there is an activity stream around the history and the evolution of the things in that schema. The same thing is true with other wiki approaches. So data.gov or CMS is leveraging data.gov's use of the Virtuoso tool, and so you can put a wiki front end on that. So that sort of thing.
And then how do you introduce parental control?
Parental control? Well, it's the same way you do in the social community of interest, right? So, we're friends because we're that community of interest, right? So, there's no magic there. I think we don't need to overdo the governance aspect of it. Is probably a bad thing to try to start out with. That sort of inhibits the just do it approach.
John, speaker two, if I can get. Is it working?
Yeah, I had a question that is important for, I think, all three speakers, but I'll ask it right now, and that is the problem that we have in working with people who are in commercial IT departments, the basic people who have grown up with conventional programming languages and databases over periods of half a century, have a traditional way of working that is totally, as they say, disconnected from anything that's being done with the semantic web or artificial intelligence and all these great new things we're talking about. And one of the things that I've been concerned with in particular is developing tools and technology that can bridge that gap. And I would like to know what kind of problems that you have run into in bridging that gap between the traditional technology and the new semantic technology. What kind of things have you found that can help, and what kind of things would you like to see for the future that would help to make it simpler
yes.
and better?
Yes, can hear you. All
right. So one of the things I'd like to see for the future, which is sort of in the spirit of what this this year's Ontolog Summit has been focusing on, is what are the applications that current technologies just don't do well. Relational database, person will tell you relational databases can do everything. Well, I doubt that. I think there are probably a class of applications that we strain relational database technology to move into, and a careful delineation of applications or probable applications. And I know a little about this, but I'd like to know more of what new application space we can enter more conveniently with the semantic technology. In terms of building bridges, I guess in my mind the one strand of object-oriented programming is sort of a natural bridge in the sense of objects and instances look a little bit like classes and so forth in this environment. So when I am talking with traditional IT people, if they know anything about object-oriented programming, that's sort of the connection I'll try to draw. There's got to be, especially in the federal government, where it's always dangerous to try something new, and we have probably a well-deserved reputation of being late adopters of new technologies. It takes a particular push to move a federal agency over the early adoption hump to take the risk of trying something new. And compelling new applications, I think, is the thing I'd like to put most emphasis on.
I'll just add one quick thing to that. One of the aspects of the W3C Government Linked Data Charter is to address procurement. So the idea here is to help agencies understand what to ask for. And part of that will link to, or point to, I'll say, the characterizations of the different tools that and skills that are out there. So there's going to be an effort to, if you want to write a contract, to go get yourself some of that semantic stuff. Here are some of the considerations you might want to take a look at.
Okay. Well, the thing I was concerned about, I had been working at IBM for 30 years and having to interface research to development. And one of the things that we discovered is that the best way to reach the developers is for the people in research to learn what the developers actually need and how they work and build those bridges. And one of the concerns that I find in a lot of the work that's being done in the real high-end semantic systems is that the semantic systems people think, well, those people who are doing commercial IT have to come over to our side, and they don't want to meet them halfway. And I think that's where the people who are doing semantic systems have some of the cutting-edge technology, and we should really build our systems in such a way that we invite them to come in. And my motto is, the simplest way to make people virtuous is to make virtue the path of least resistance. So if you want the IT people to be virtuous, make it so simple that the semantic systems simplify it for the IT people as well.
I know that some people consider the semantic web and linked data too simple compared to the goals of a group like this. I told Peter I thought you should think of the semantic web as your lost leader.
Oh.
Get your foot in the door to people that can see what's going on, and then move them up the stack as time goes on.
Oh no, I don't consider the linked data too simple. I think it's too complex, because there is where we really have to do true natural language. In order to build vocabularies, we have to address the actual documents and extract the vocabularies from those documents. That's the real challenge.
Okay, folks, and we just want to keep this informal. So I would suggest that all the panelists, if you want to make a contribution even before you've given your presentation, feel free to comment. We're going to have time, and I'll make sure that every panelist has probably 10 minutes at this point. And then the audience, treat this as an informal question and answer period too, because I think that it's worthwhile to have these conversations and ask these questions as we're going through. Okay, Peter.
I have an informal question for George Thomas. Given everything that's in the blogosphere about data.gov's future in view of the budget crunch, do you have a crystal ball on how data.gov is going to be like in maybe 3 to 6 months?
I do have a crystal ball, and I cannot comment on that.
So, any comment on Standard and Poor? No. okay, well then maybe we should shift to our next panelist, who is Dennis Wisnowski. Dennis, did you want to do the slides first or the video? Video? And probably the this one. Let's see. And for our remote viewers, can we provide the password? Do you know? Yeah, okay. So folks on the phone and here, if you wish to view it on your local machine, the password is popcorn, all lowercase. Well, he just mentioned it, so. Okay. Okay, let's see. Maybe we should download it then, or.
Hello, I'm Dennis Wisnowski. Welcome to the world of DoD Semantic Technology. We all know we have many information technology challenges. One of the greatest challenges is making use of the number of structured and unstructured data sources that we must access in order to make timely, informed decisions. Even though we solve the challenge of accessing the data, we still don't be able to make much sense of it. Each data source has its own schema or data description approach with little useful metadata that can tell people and machine processes just what the data means and whether it is relevant to the decision maker. To keep up with the ever-changing times and yet still utilizing what we already have, we must change the way we store, access, and share data. Taking on a semantic approach to data is the path forward. Let me show you how we're doing it. To add meaning, what is referred to as semantics to the data, common vocabulary is created within domains of interest. Relevant data concepts in the domain are captured along with their properties and structured according to their relationships. This structure is called an ontology. The ontology is the schema that describes the vocabulary of a domain. This creates a level of useful metadata in which humans and computers can determine the relevance of actual instance data to their activities and goals. To connect ontology metadata to actual instance data, there needs to be a way to look at the data as defined by the ontology. Instance data, expressed through the ontology, represents assertions about particular domain elements. You can think of this as the authoritative content, now in an understandable form, for what was just stovepipes of structured and unstructured data. Translations between the authoritative data and the ontology occur in semantic tools that allow semantic query and visualization. A great effort has been made in finding the right DoD approach to semantic technology. Two pioneering semantic business intelligence applications have been designed to show the power and benefits of the semantic approach. Through these applications, we're exploring alternative ways of finding and exposing data. This includes dynamic access of authoritative data from various sources, ad hoc semantic representations, and the creation of semantic repositories hold semantic instance data over a period of time. One of the greatest benefits of the semantic approach is that it allows for change, reuse, and extension without modifying systems or the underlying code. Semantic technology increases the agility and responsiveness of IT solutions, meaning that data can be pulled from many places at once with much less effort and it reduces the total cost of ownership. Semantic technology is the future of the DoD enterprise. Join us as we all move forward with this pioneering spirit of ingenuity, simplicity, and the modernization of our data management processes.
That is a home movie. We did it ourselves. We didn't contract that out. My people wrote the script. You can turn it off. That's about 80%. It's actually done for a talk I'm giving next week in South America. I tested it last week at the Enterprise Architecture Conference with 4,000 people or so. It's our attempt to get this message out in 3 minutes and 40 seconds in a way that our executives can understand. Any ideas or suggestions you real ontologists might have, I would certainly welcome. That's my imitation of Neil deGrasse Tyson there with all those flashy things going on. I only have three slides. This one is another one of our all-in slides that show how serious we are about this entire semantic web thing. Beginning with building enterprise architectures and making this technology humanly consumable. We have two projects, as I mentioned there in the video. One of them is Human Resources Enterprise Information Web. This was born out of necessity when we had the DIMRIS program, which was Defense Integrated Management Human Resources System, that lasted about 11 years and spent well over $1 billion and ended up with nothing that anybody wanted to try to even think about, maybe possibly someday, maybe implementing. It was a waste. I can say that, and many others will agree. But maybe in hindsight, it would have been the thing that got us in this direction. We are 45 years or so into relational databases. It began when I began my career. We're about 11 years into the semantic web. When the DIMRIS project failed, which was to build a giant data warehouse for the entire Department of Defense for the military side, for personnel and pay, the go-forward plan was to build another warehouse, this time at the OSD level. It seemed to me that wasn't a good idea. And so casting about for how to do this in a way that we could start experimentally and get better, we decided that we would go for the semantic web technologies to build data stores when we need to that are non-persistent with RDF and OWL, and to build mapping ontologies to domain ontologies that would initially be native and ultimately will be in their own RDF triple store format. That's what all this stuff here is. The domain ontology for the department is a non-persistent real-time or near real-time pool from authoritative data sources that might be anywhere in the department or might be somewhere else. On a ship or in some external domain. We are the business mission area, that's my job, and this is the description of the business enterprise architecture. However, we have other domain vocabularies that we have to deal with, both our own warfighters and also our partners. All of this is the business enterprise architecture, which is a massive data store, but non-persistent. It doesn't exist for real. It exists only when we need to use it for some particular purpose. That purpose is defined by this. This is the object management group primitives. Last year, we got the OMG to agree on, it's called analytical conformance class 2.0 for building BPMN models. We are now constructing an ontology of BPMN, and our goal with this ontology is to be able to actually execute these models. That's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen for the models that are for the data models or the business process models as complex as we have for a while, but that's our direction. So the user executes this business process model. The business process model was constructed initially to inform whichever particular domain we were interested in at that time. I mentioned two projects. One of them is HR. You'll hear HREIW, Human Resources Enterprise Information Web, in the department. we've constructed or are constructing this set of applications or services in three-month intervals, so every 90 days. We call them pods, proof of delivery. So we are in our sixth pod now, at the end of March. So sixth pod, every 3 months we deliver something new, and this something new tests the ontology more than the one previous did. For example, this one has a thing called a sparkalizer that turns a query, English language query, into SQL code. And then that goes to the authoritative data source that could be in any one of these domains. Over here, because the BEA by law is required for guiding and constraining investments, it is the repository of all of our standards, whether they're business rules that tell how this is executed, or business rules that tell us how we can create a taxonomy or particular data element in less than 5 years, and that was pretty good way that it traditionally has happened. So those are the business rules. Now, nothing gets into our Com Vocabulary repository, which itself is an RDF triple store, unless it is linked to and through a particular business process model. So imagine that we someday, now beginning small with HR, and our next one we're doing actually simultaneously is performance data automation. All this collection of business process models, all built according to the standard, all sitting on top of RDF triple stores. That's the vision here, my job, to create the vision and then to start moving us all in that direction. Now, how quickly is this happening? The next slide. We cannot do this kind of thing without total support of top management. I am the technologist. I am not putting myself in the position of being in the governance path. That's the job of the DSDs, the Deputy Undersecretaries of Defense, of whom one of them is the person I report to, Beth McGrath. This is a memo that was released on April 4th. It took relatively short time, about 5 months, to get it coordinated through the CAO and everybody else. But that's record time. Just like the guy just broke the Boston Marathon with a tailwind. We didn't have a tailwind, but we did this in a few months. Beth is totally behind using these end-to-end business processes, using this approach to build business process models for BPR, for Lean Six Sigma. And the next slide, most importantly, and as the guy on television says, and that's not all, look at these words. When I hear people say we can't talk about architecture and we can't talk about common vocabularies or ontologies and we can't talk about things like Sparkle and OWL and RDF, I say, who are you talking to? Are your seniors not as smart as mine? I don't think they are. I think maybe we're being a little too pusillanimous in our approach to this. We have to get these things on the table. On the table. We are in the first third of the development of this technology. Technologies have about a 30-year life cycle. Then they get up to that asymptote where relational and all these other things are right now. And just go back to where PCs entered. Hey, we're not breaking Moore's Law so easily anymore. About 30 years into their life. So this right side here, this says exactly how these models are going to be built and put into the business enterprise architecture, which the rest of the department must follow. They don't get their money. So we have that part of it under control also. They don't get their money. They come to an investment review board. We say, do you have a business process model? They'll say, yes, sir. Is it built in BPMN primitives, analytical conformance class 2.0 OMG, they say no, we send them back home. If they say yes, we say, does it sit on top of an RDF triple store? They say no, we say back and try it again, literally. That's what's going to be happening. We're putting together the plans right now, step by step, to go in this direction, now that this memo has been issued, and putting together the training program and all the other things we have to have to, just like the space program of 30 years ago, gradually get there. Up through the atmosphere, around the Earth, to the moon and back, and then man on the moon. That's my story. Thanks.
Thank you. Mills?
Just quick thing. How do you anticipate handling the evolution of standards? Because we'll see a convergence and evolution, of a number of issues.
Right. Yes. About 30 years ago, when I was a kid, In this very building, we started a thing called the Integrated Computer-Aided Manufacturing Program. Anybody remember that? Remember the IDEF, certainly, IDEF 0, IDEF 1, 1X. That began with that program. There was another thing that began with that program, which was called IGES, Initial Graphics Exchange Specification. And there's another program here in another room that STEP, which is son, grandson, or I guess it's really son of I think it's grandson of IGES. So, son. So we started, well, there was PDES in between. That didn't last very long. But we intend to lead it. We intend to lead it. The DoD did that at one time. My management is all for that. That doesn't mean dictating it. It doesn't mean that. It means that when it's good enough for us to try it and see what happens and then take the next step, we will adopt it and the rest of the world will follow if they want to. This is America. Don't have to, but it's going to be in our RFPs the same way that IGES was in those RFPs, the same way that IDEF was in RFPs back when we had a much smaller defense budget and had to have projects that work together. That's our approach here. That makes sense?
Yeah. Nicola?
Don't you find expressivity problems trying to squeeze the complexity of this system, the business architecture, into the poor primitives of OWL and BPMN? I mean, do people at the business level, do people actually deal with these things, or do they need something more understandable towards their minds?
Very good question. If someone could show me a more understandable tool, I'd be happy to look at it. The expressivity of this is limited on purpose, the same way that, and it's limited by mathematics, the same way that music is limited by mathematics. The primitives is the set of notes that we're allowed to use and the staff and the timing and all of that. And then underneath that is mathematics that, as far as I know, has never limited the expressivity of musicians. In engineering, as electrical engineer, we have certain number of symbols. When we need to invent a new symbol, like a transistor, because it didn't exist, we could invent that symbol. But up until that time, we use the symbols that we have agreed upon. Periodic table of the elements. When I was a student, there were 103. Now there are 117. But most of us don't care about all of them. We just care about a few for our purpose. As we build these business process models, we're very carefully focusing on those class of problems that are necessary and sufficient for the expressivity we've decided upon or standard already. When we find that, and we will, that we need to create more, we will do that as well. But our initial intentional purpose is to limit expressivity, because when we've let it be anything, it has been anything. And everything, we've not been able to deal with it, except by pouring more and more money at the problem. Ma'am.
Answer that from a slightly different perspective, Mr. Wisnowski. We haven't met, but I spent 3 years on the Air Force EBT. Oh. And I'll say from the ground level implementation, the answer is absolutely yes. But it was a slightly different question, I think, than possibly you understood it to be, and it has to do with the logical expressivity of these languages in particular. The constraints of RDF OWL make it very, very hard to train especially less experienced modelers, ontologists that work with the functional areas and so forth, to be able to express either information from the business models or information or what's in the relationships needed to semantically specify the information services. It's actually much more difficult with the restricted expressivity of OWL than it is with a first order logic level language. And it's a real obstacle. It's a real difficulty on the ground at that level. So, I would say we're already there where we need something better. I get to say that because I'm not on the project anymore.
Very, very quick. I'd just like to agree with Amanda. It seems like it's simpler to reduce the amount of expressivity. And then when you have something that you really need to express, use all these workarounds, and it gets very complex, and it's not such a good idea. But there is the trade-off with inferencing. If you need inferencing to go a certain speed, then you have to make these workarounds. It's always a trade-off.
We're not going to allow workarounds. We're going to change the problem we're trying to solve. That's how we will do it. I'm a pilot. Any pilots in here? I use a lot of flying examples. One of them is that the expressivity of mankind for language is one for every country, mostly, and some countries have more than one. Africa, in most countries, like Tanzania, there are 125 tribes, 125 languages, but the official language is English of business, and then everybody speaks Swahili. Imagine if you tried to fly over that country and allowed that to happen. In air traffic, it's English, period. And the charts are JEP charts, American, or NOS charts, American, period. And when I'm flying my airplane, even if my plan is to fly straight from Chicago to Washington, there's a big cloud in the way, I'm going to change the problem and go around it or land before that. So we're reducing, initially, the scope of these problems to what we know we can work without workaround, and then as we discover what we need to add, we will add that expressivity, including down to the execution level. I'm sure we'll cause more things to be invented as we go along, but initially, we're not allowing that. By the way, I just was supposed to be 5 years, that I was initial. When the sixth year came, they changed it to interim.
That's still interim.
Yes, it is.
Corey first, John, and then... Corey first.
I'd like to point to what just happened, and that there's a fractionalization in the ontology community. There's a linked open data community, the OWL community, which is different from that, the first order logic and common logic's about to speak. So, what I'd like to ask the panel is, how is that fractionalization compromised your ability to proceed, and what can we do about it?
I'd say quickly, from a historical perspective, I don't see anything new here. I've been involved with programming languages for a long time, and this is exactly the process we've gone through, let's say, in the algorithmic programming languages that are most common. Fortran and COBOL, man, did we gripe about them when we needed more expressivity. PL1 tried it. Well, it may be over exceeded. Then we cut back to other languages. Now we've ended up with the C and the C++ and so on and so forth. And, of course, we still have Fortran, although there's a saying that scientists will use any language in the world as long as it's named Fortran. And there's some truth in that as time goes on, additional capabilities and additional functionalities are added in to a language as we figure out what the best way to add those functionalities are. So I can certainly believe you all when you say that first-order language and other more expressive technologies are closer to what we really need to express our day-to-day problems. And starting somewhere with an inadequate language that does something, gets the ball rolling. I'm very anxious for the foot in the door and what can we do, and then once we are doing what we can do, we see for ourselves, hey, we can't do X because the language isn't expressive enough. Well, by that time, you guys have got the edges rubbed off those additional capabilities, and they're being retrofitted into the next version of the language or a new language. And I think this is perfectly valid way to proceed. I wish it would proceed instantaneously, but I don't expect it to.
John.
Yeah. Okay. The only point I wanted to emphasize is what Amanda was saying. And she had been working with Psyche, which is a very expressive language that encompasses everything. And Psyche already took that path. When it started in 1984, it had an approach that was very, very similar to what RDF and OWL supports today. And during the past 30 years or so, they discovered that they needed more and more and more and more. And so psych, I think, is now the future of where the W3C will be in another 10 years. And if we really want to know where the future is, there's psych. That's an excellent example. But psych still has not yet made that bridge to the legacy stuff. And the legacy stuff, by the way, every programming language is undecidable. Every programming language has far more expressive power than RDF and OWL. And we will need that expressive power when we want to build that bridge. If we want to build a bridge to bring the legacy software into the modern age, we are going to need that full expressive power. We can't deal with it with just the tools that we got for today.
Michael?
Yeah, so I think maybe the metaphor to use perhaps is not musical notes for expressiveness, but I think it's in terms of tools. So logics are tools, as Bill just kind of mentioned to me. And I think the analogy would be if you are building a house, I use a different saw for cutting wood than for cutting tile. I cannot cut wood with a hammer. And so what we need to do is to say, well, what do I really need to cut? So if I'm not putting in new tile in my kitchen, if I'm only cutting wood, I don't need the tile saw. I only need the wood saw. But if I really need to cut the tile, then I need that tile saw. And so what we really need to keep a focus on is what do we really need, and to use the kind of the minimally expressive language to do what we really need. But we also have to be really honest about what we need and not to compromise, because then we will be in the situation, as George Strawn said back in the 80s with expert systems, of promising things that we won't be able to deliver, because if we're promising to cut tile and we're only delivering wood saws, then we're going to be in trouble. So.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Wisniewski. I'd like to address this. You've changed the tone of the conversation a little bit from with your April 4 mandate. I'm curious to the size and cost of your staff to implement this, because basically all of this is always going to come down to your operating cost and your ongoing cost of implementation. So I'm curious.
Okay, before I say that, I would say that the saw and the hammer, those are execution engines. We're talking about the blueprinting here. That's a whole different thing. And that's what this BPMN stuff is all about. Rather than back to you, I don't have a staff. When I started this job, my condition was, since I've had staffs in the past, especially when I worked for the government a long, long time ago, when we did the IDEFs, I had a staff at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Then I spent 25 years in the private sector, I had big staffs. And here I said, no staff and no money. And that's been true. So this work is being done by a coalition of the willing. It's being done by the people who are responsible for execution of their programs. And my job is the leadership role. So far, what we've seen is doing these projects this way costs less and takes less time than the traditional way. We've met every single deliverable. When Dave Wintergreen, who's a former CIO, now deputy to Beth McGrath, asked us what our delivery date was for Pod 8, he said, you don't have to tell me now. Wait a minute, I know what it is. It's December 31st of 2010. I know what it is. Now, exactly what it's going to be, I reserve the right plus or minus 10% to say that right now, because we're doing these things in three-month intervals. If we were doing them in, like Dimers was, 11 years, or like some other things are, perpetual annuities for big companies, I couldn't be so happy about or confident about what I'm saying here.
Okay, so I'm pretty new to this community. This is my first meeting ever. And I've discovered in the last 2 days that I know a lot less about ontologies than I thought I did walking in the door. So. And I'm one who, like, goes out on the edge, like, quick story. The way that my family stopped going to church is when I pointed out to the Sunday school teacher that, you know, her issue with creationism versus evolution could be solved by saying that God was an ape. That way everyone's happy. So I'm hoping this comment doesn't follow suit and result in the exclusion of us from that community. But so, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, aren't ontologies supposed to craft interoperability, right? Isn't that the message that I've gotten here? So could it be that there would be an ontology for expressivity that would solve this issue? Like a layer around?
Maybe.
I still want to go to church here, just by the way. but see, I mean,
Bill, did you have your hand up there?
All right, well, that's that.
Speaker.
Yeah, that last comment, I think, belongs in the philosophy department, not in the church, right?
Yeah. Well, so, but the issue is expressivity and interoperability in these various systems that are evolving. We have one perspective here, perspective there, perspective everywhere, and the globalization is, you know, bringing it all into one system is the idea, right?
It's not my idea, but someone's
okay.
Idea, yeah.
All right.
Can I just say a quick answer to that? I think Evan Wallace is in the room, but the meta-object facility with the ontology data meta model would be kind of where she's headed, I think, in terms of an ontology for languages for interoperability. But I'll stop.
Oh, okay.
I mean, for this comment, we really, you know, I'll defer instantly to our resident historian, John Soa, who could give the definitive answer. But the difference, the analogy was made before between the uptake of so-called semantic web technologies and relational technology. But if you look at the actual history of how that worked, the first relational database implementation, I guess, that was successful was System R, right, John? The first large-scale implementation? Yeah. Right. But the point was that the time span between the release of Codd's paper and the release of Codd's paper and the existence of successful relational database implementations was quite short. Nothing so long as what we're seeing now. And the difference was that those relational databases answered an operational need. People saw an application for them and they used them, and they used them successfully. The difference here is we're talking about the application and stipulation of standards and technology prior to saying what it is we're going to do with them. And this was an amplification of Michael's point. And I think the analogy with relational technology just doesn't hold up.
We have over here, two, and then here.
Hi, it's Mike Bennett. Hi, Dennis. I was actually going to pick up a specific thing which feeds into this same conversation. So you've got the OMG primitives for business process modeling, and my question in my mind was, is that more or less primitive than PetriNet primitives? So, you know, how do you get that mathematical simplicity you were saying? And the reason I mentioned that is going back to the question of how you describe these languages and a MoF type of thing. I think the problem with MoF, it deals only with level of abstraction in an object-oriented kind of thing. And we actually need at least two other dimensions. We need a dimension of how a given language links to recognized families of formal logic, and a dimension of model theory, what is the relationship between the thing being modeled and the model. And if we can find some common framework for describing languages that brings it down to the mathematical, musical simplicity you described, something like some of the stuff the OMG are starting to look at possibly, then I think that could be the way forward. That's my guess.
Right. I totally agree with what you just said, and certainly also admit that no metaphor is perfect. We have to use them to explain something as seemingly complex as this. Appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Right here. And then here.
This is just a quick comment and a thanks for the props to George Strom. I dropped out of the real world, and I'm in the doctoral program at the School of Information and Library Science at UNC Chapel Hill. And my main interests are like digital curation and ontologies and classifications. But one of the things that I've really noticed is that depending on the background on which people come into, whether they've previously been exposed to databases or previously been exposed to object-oriented programming, or if they're coming into it from cataloging and classification directly, each different group has different cognitive issues dealing with ontologies. And I was wondering if at the NCO NITA D PCAS thing, if you had come up with any of the issues, and this is also for the other panelists, any issues where you think the real skill set is needed and where the existing skills really need to be retrained or remodeled to meet the needs that you're seeing?
I would just second your comment that the context that a person brings influences their understanding of the text very much. The tutorial I've put forward so far seems to work for people who have a programming background. Well, that's my background, so that's what I do. And people who don't have a programming background are as mystified by my tutorial as they are about other approaches. So you sort of have to consider the approach of, say, a person who only knows the web but doesn't know programming. What can you, what metaphors do you use? How do you proceed to tell them about semantic web or other technologies? Librarians with their background and skills, I think, are sort of closer in some sense to some of the things that we need in ontological thinking. You know, computer scientists these days are impressed with the phrase that Jeanette Wing introduced a couple years ago called computational thinking. And we're worrying about how we press computational thinking down into the public school level. Well, maybe we need ontological thinking as well, whatever that might mean, to get things going. But I have no, I've already said more than I know.
Okay, over here. It may not be working.
Oh, is it working?
Okay, good.
I grabbed the microphone initially to get involved in the expressiveness and vocabulary conversation, and then the gentleman in the purple brought up a point that was interesting also. The first one is spent a fair amount of time on conference calls with Jim Hendler and Andy Seaborn arguing on expressiveness versus computability, and we ultimately compromised by having different profiles. So the EL++ profile is intended to be polynomial, and computable, and that was the way we kind of migrated through the problem on the spec committee, is just give everybody what they want. But that was the intent behind it. But the second point I thought was more interesting, which was I was part of the first batch of computer science degrees, and now I'm a professor at Villanova. When I was getting my computer science degree, the thought of getting out, and I was in California, and not being fully conversant in Unix and relational databases at a bachelor's level was just unheard of. So as we went into industry, we pushed for those technologies. Villanova recruited me the same time RPI recruited Jim Hendler, and was with the intent to get this out. But if I look at relational databases as taking 9 years from theory into production in the industry, we're well beyond that. The semantic web spec started in 97. And the point I come back to is that people aren't coming out of college with the background or knowledge or business equation. So then when they go into the workforce, it's not a tool in their arsenal. That's been the part that I've seen.
Are not.
I think Mike Oshold then.
Oh, actually, I had a number of different things, right? But I wanted to come back to the issue of the expressivity. So this is a long, that was a great question. I don't know your name, but that was a terrific question. How to marry all these things in one formalism. And it really is, it's, as Bill says, it's a bit of a philosophy problem, but it's also a problem for logicians. And there's really advanced logics, and it's not a problem that's going to be solved anytime soon. And the Villanova professor, I think, pointed out really what's the most important thing now is there are different variations of things that can be used different times. Another thing I wanted to ask was George Strawn, I think. You said you have been putting together materials for teaching to I would love to see those materials. Can they be made available to the community?
How much will you pay? Yes, they can.
Okay, thank you. That would be excellent.
Okay, I actually have a question. And it's not really to do with ontologies. It's to do with sociology. Personally, I've seen that one of the main hindrances is in incorporation of any new technology, but including ontologies and semantic web and semantic technologies, is the business environment, the processes that exist. In the DoD, often I see champions arise, and they're individuals who are visionaries, and they can accomplish a lot while they're there. Often, though, it doesn't seem like these things are institutionalized, so the processes actually change, and then when they leave, there is a kind of deficit, if you will, memory lost, and of course, the impetus for change is gone sometimes.
Well, it sounds like we're talking about the old DARPA versus the new DARPA. The old DARPA was able to sustain the ARPANET for 20, 25 years, and look at the technology transfer we got there after NSF picked it up and made it NSFNet, and then the commercial sector picked it up and we had the internet. And as the recent DARPA has gone through a shorter-term focus rather than a longer-term focus, we have Handler and Company doing the what resulted in OWL a decade ago at DARPA, and then not a lot of work follow-on in DARPA, it appears to me. You may be able to tell me otherwise, but seems like there's a shorter focus, and I, of course, am sorrowful for that. I will say that DOD still sort of remains my new technology hero as far as the federal government goes. As we heard earlier, I think it's more likely that a new technology, whether it's the internet or semantic technologies, arises first in our more command and control environment of the Defense Department, and then can trickle over or down into the civilian agencies once it gets tested out. If you've read the book called Super Capitalism by Clinton's former labor secretary, Robert Reich, he makes the point that he thinks that almost all of the technological advances of the post-World War II era are complements of the Cold War, and the tremendous technological innovation that was invested in DOD and related activities because of that. Well, in any event, DOD seems to be able to push this stuff through and out more rapidly, and then we civilian agencies come along and pick up the good stuff. But I wish we could get back to a 30-year DARPA time frame.
Right, we're not going to get back to that, in my opinion. We have a lot of oversight. The DOD does probably more than any other agency. I'm not sure about that, but a lot of oversight. So we can fight that oversight, or we can figure out a way to work with it. And we've chosen the latter. The NDA 2005 established the need for an architecture to guide and constrain investments. My job was to figure out how. The NDA 2008 established the office of the DCMO, where I work. The NDA 2010 said that we would need to do business process reengineering. My job was to figure out how to do it. There was one I missed. NDA 2006, I think, was the one that established Lean Six Sigma as a way forward for performance management. My job was to figure out how to do it. Now, to me, these are the same problem. And so I don't know whether we'll see a law that says that we must use semantic technologies. I don't know about that. If we could figure out how to write it and get someone to do it, we will. But in the meantime, this memo puts all of the things I just said together as a requirement from the top down for all business, which is 52% of the department's expenditure. So my job isn't to get it done, it's to get it started and to get enough people understanding the way forward and believing in it that long after I'm gone, it will continue. These laws, once they're written, can be changed, but it's a lot harder to change them than it is to get them in there in the first place.
Folks, I think we need to take a break now. We'll convene at 11 o'clock, and the other panelists will present, and we'll continue the discussion. Feel free in between to continue these discussions.
There was papers. Oh, so everybody has a different one. I mean, there's. So you're the one you card versus matched.